Hello there, and welcome to the Comic Book Tesseract, the weekly comics netcast that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. I'm Justin Chalupka. Every week, we review and preview the world of comics, along with other facets of geek chic culture. Rather interesting week this week. I actually have just gotten back from the most magical place on Earth, which was kind of stressful for me for reasons that I'd rather not go into on this show, but for those of you who know me personally might understand why that would be a high-stress situation for me.
And it had nothing to do with your daughter.
It had nothing to do with my daughter at all.
Yeah. Because taking your daughter to Disney World is always a no-stress situation.
Well, taking my daughter anywhere is always a no-stress situation.
Yes, but it's taking your daughter to Disney to see all the fun princesses and animals and characters that she loves.
And she had a great time, so I can't hold that against her. But I was a nervous wreck while I was there. I didn't breathe easily until I was off the property.
So, yeah, yes. Well, that's other stressful situations as to why you were there.
You're right, and
I could think of a couple of sources of stress while you were there.
Yeah.
It didn't involve your daughter.
True.
So.
True. And it actually not that bad. Could have been a lot worse. Weren't that bad.
Yes.
And aside from all this inside baseball, Mr. Jason Poliev, how have you been doing this week, sir?
I've had a wonderful week.
Yeah.
Looking forward, we got the holidays coming up. Going to get a chance to see an old friend who lives out of state. He's coming in to visit his family.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be going up to visit my family. We'll have some chance to hang out, get to see some of my old friends from high school.
Cool.
That's what the holidays are for, family and friends.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, that and trying to avoid family as much as possible in some cases, but...
Depends on the stressors involved in those situations.
Yeah, depends on the family. I'm actually looking forward to seeing my family. I got my mother coming in from out of state, and I'll be seeing my stepbrothers, actually, who one is from out of state and one who I just don't get to see very often. So it'll be good meeting up with them and hanging out and just having an overall good time. But anyways, people didn't come to hear us talk about our family and our stressors. They came here to hear us talk about comics and other geek-related stuff, so... Let's go ahead and jump right in and talk about the first book we both read this week that is kind of worth mentioning. And that was Green Lantern number 4. Of course, this week is the week of number 4s for all the DCU. This book in particular, I'm starting to wonder, when is Green Lantern going to get handed back to Hal as being the primary character?
And I don't really care. I'm enjoying the dynamic of Hal versus Sinestro. We actually get to see why Sinestro was the greatest Green Lantern of all time before Hal, and why Hal may or may not be a better Green Lantern.
Yeah, but with Sinestro being so much on the forefront, I almost wonder if he's going to end up falling to the same type of character fatigue that we discussed last week when we were talking about Joker and how sometimes he had to kind of step out of that limelight for a while, let some other kind of B-listers, or not even necessarily B-listers, other good villains, but just other villains, really take over and show their stuff, let them be an actual... terrifying force for a period of time, so that way when Joker comes back and you see really how bad he is in comparison to those, that it reinforces that villain of how strong he is.
But there's a difference between the Joker and Sinestro, particularly in this story arc. The Joker is a straight up, always will be a villain. Here, you've got Hal dealing with a person he doesn't like, a person he has respect for, and that he respects the abilities, but he certainly doesn't respect him as a person.
Well, he doesn't agree with his ideology. So I don't even know if you could say he respects his ideology, because...
But he certainly respects what Sinestro can do with the ring.
Absolutely.
And his skills. But Sinestro is actually, despite being a prick, despite being arrogant,
Sinestro is
a hero in this arc, which is certainly a twist from... Now, he's certainly remembered as being the villain that he is, and he's certainly remembered for the evil he did, thinking he was doing good, as we see in this issue, as he faces the citizens of Khorogar that have been that were oppressed under his regime, and then further repressed and actually forced to suffer much more so under the Yellow Lantern Corps while Sinestro was away.
I don't know. I think this is more of... not necessarily trying to make him a hero, but instead trying to make him the sympathetic villain. The same type of thing they tried to do with Black Adam back in the day, where they tried to show his motivation. They tried to show why he did the things he did. The difference here is that regardless of how heroic Sinestro thinks he's being, when it comes down to it, he was a villain. In no other, you know, acceptable means of defining the term. He was a villain, and the Yellow Corps is doing nothing more than what his regime, even under him, would have eventually ended up becoming, whether he wants to admit it to himself or not.
Well, he doesn't want to admit it to himself. That's part of where the story arc comes from. And you know, maybe it will end with him finally being redeemed and realizing that his regime ruling Korugar, which, yes, it was the most peaceful planet anywhere in the galaxy at the time, it was only because his citizens were so scared of him that they were so pressed down by his thumb that they didn't react out of fear for him. It only got worse, and worse in a way that it wouldn't have gotten under him because he would never allow it. He was after law and order. Unfortunately, he went about it in such a way. That's one of the big themes that Green Lantern has throughout all of its books, particularly with the colors, is that just because an emotion such as love is thought of as good, when taken to an extreme such as jealousy, it becomes something evil. So Sinestro originally was the Green Lantern that will push to the extreme where his will was forced on everybody on that planet to the point that they could no longer be free beings. They were enslaved, and yes, it was a peaceful society, and
peaceful in the same way that a max security prison is peaceful.
There's no fighting, you know, everybody seems to get along.
Until the one time it does.
But then he puts it down, just like they launched the tear gas into the cafeteria, and things go back to the previous status quo. So, but again, it's dealing with that whole bringing different emotions to an extreme that you see throughout the different colors. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of the things they've kind of started to pull off with the Red Lantern. That while I haven't been reading the Red Lantern Corps solo series, you know, one of the things they started to illustrate in the Green Lantern Corps book before the reboot was how just because you're angry doesn't mean you can't use that for a positive gain. Mm-hmm. Now, it's certainly much harder to control anger and do something positive with it.
Just as love is on the other end of the spectrum. And that was one of the things I think I remember John saying in an interview back in perhaps San Diego Comic-Con a year or two of years ago, was the colors at the ends of the spectrum. Violet of love and the red of anger are at the end of the spectrum because they're the most unstable. They're the ones that have the greatest fluctuation and the most difficult to control. Mm-hmm. Whereas the reason the Guardians chose green because it was right smack dab in the middle, it was the easiest to control. But like you're saying, even willpower taken to extreme has negative consequences.
And fear, while it's traditionally portrayed as evil, we go all the way back to the beginnings of comics with the second great superhero, Batman, using fear to scare the cowardly and superstitious criminals from, you know, doing their dastardly deeds.
Yeah. Oh, so, as an interesting side note, Batman Arkham City just released a big download patch of all the different costumes you can get for Batman. One of the ones that's available in the pack is Batman in a Yellow Lantern costume.
Because he was offered the ring for
many
the
times. Yellow at least twice that I know of. Possibly three times.
So, but again, it's the dynamic that they're building throughout this book. I like seeing Sinestro in this part, and you'll probably be another, I think, two issues at least that will have Sinestro playing this key role in this book. I'm not sure where Johns is going to take it, you know, after that, if we're going to leave Sinestro and Hal's going to get his ring back, if they're going to redeem Sinestro, put him back as the, you know, highest level guardian, you know, for the Green Lanterns.
Well, there's an interesting thought. What would happen if...
Can he actually be redeemed?
Well, not only the redemption issue, but the Guardians have tried doing the sort of the MP of the Green Lanterns in the form of the Alpha Lanterns, in the form of the Manhunters. Yeah. Wouldn't it be interesting to see how they've made these mistakes to make yet another mistake, at least in my opinion, and put Sinestro in that position? Like, basically have Sinestro be the fear that keeps the other Green Lanterns in line.
I don't think the Guardians would do that.
Yeah. Well, certainly not from what we've seen from Green Lantern Corps, where they have like the lobotomized, the, you know, unemotional, detached type of thing. But I could definitely see Sinestro kind of filling that unemotional role of him saying, look, this is law, this is order, you do it or you get smacked down. And him being the only one that's really capable of doing that while still not succumbing to the issues that the robotic versions did.
Well, yeah, and yeah, the Manhunters weren't actually designed to be a internal affairs system. They were actually designed to be the cops of the universe, but they were too logical.
Before the Lanterns.
They were too logical.
Right.
And now now that they're using biological species from different planets as the Green Lanterns, the Guardians are feeling they were too emotional. That's why they built the Alpha Lanterns, part Manhunters, part biological species, to try and combine the best of those two creations. And yeah, what wound up happening is it blew up in their face yet again.
Yeah. You would think for creatures that are supposed to be so omniscient and so all powerful, some dumbass little Smurfs, aren't they?
They certainly do make their number of mistakes. Yeah. And part of that is they refuse to acknowledge that they have emotions. And I think that's actually that they do have emotions, that they have fear, is why they won't place Sinestro in that internal affairs position. Mm-hmm. And they've already shown they're reluctant to have him on the core. They tried to take the ring from him at the beginning of the series. So, you know, with Sinestro having the ring, you know, they may or may not actually get it from him. Yeah, he'll certainly go back and get a yellow ring if he doesn't have a green ring.
Yeah, well, maybe not. I mean, with what he's done to his core, they may say, you know, to him and give him the big, you know, thumb to the teeth.
But it is his core. And he's the one that had the original ring forged from the Weaponers of Quard. So, there's a lot that can go on here. I don't think we're going to see the problem that you have with too much of the same villain showing up all the time. It's one of the things that I wish you'd see Lex Luthor fade into the background, not because he isn't that good a villain, but you need to showcase some other people periodically. And I think Lex Luthor, yeah, you see all the movies, a lot of people were upset when they heard that in the movie that they just, you know, the most recent Superman movie with Brandon Rao as Superman, yeah, there were a lot of people were upset, oh, it's just Lex Luthor again. Yeah. People want to see something like Zod step up and be the villain in a new Superman movie. Yeah, to take that, you know, Kevin Smith had written The Death and Life of Superman, where Superman faced off against Doomsday. You don't really need an origin story for Superman. He's been around so long. He's part of the zeitgeist. You don't need to tell us something that we already know. Yeah. So, yeah, you could take Superman, present him as the character that he is, that is familiar to 99.9% of the population of the world, and give a story there where you have the death of Superman, bring it back. Yeah, you can bring the emotional connection of Lois Lane in there. That was one of the things Kevin Smith wanted to do. So I think Sinestro, especially in this role of pseudo good guy, you know, a guy that we can lean on as a bad guy, but we can feel for him. I don't think he's going to get burnt out in this. And I don't think you're going to see him going head to head with Hal, maybe the last issue of this arc, and then he's going to disappear for a while, and you won't be having a head-to-head.
Yeah, or at least if he doesn't disappear completely, he'll kind of perhaps fade to the sideline. We'll hear echoes of him every now and then, but let somebody else really step in and take that villain spotlight for a while.
Who knows? You know, we may even see Hal step aside and Sinestro take center stage for a little bit more.
Possibly. Well, continuing with the number fours in the DCU this week, the other book we wanted to talk about was Suicide Squad.
Fun! Lots of fun!
Yeah, yeah. You had a good time with this book.
I did. And it's because it's villains double-crossing each other. Yeah, doing evil things, having nasty thoughts.
Well, this is what you wished Villains for Hire would have been last week.
Yeah, a lot of it is. Yeah, and certainly there's that element of we don't want to be doing this. We've got explosives in our necks. Mm-hmm. So how do we get around this? But the story was definitely much more of what I wanted. I wanted a bit more, you know, the superhero teams get along together as a cohesive unit. You know, occasionally there's a story of how they're not getting along and that's what causes them to not win the day.
Or to change up their membership, as usually tends to be the case.
Yeah. But, yeah, with the supervillains, yeah. Yeah, there's no honor among thieves. Yeah. So supposedly, you know, want people to trust you, so you're going to do a good job. But let's face it, you're going to eventually go, you know what, I got more to gain by stabbing this guy in the back than I do by actually helping him the way I said I would.
And it's interesting the way that you say that, because if what you say is true, then that means essentially Waller is as big a villain as any of the ones actually out in the team.
That's what I love about Waller.
Yeah.
Is, you know, she's willing to put these people with explosives in the next out in the field. She knows that they're going to be potential casualties of somebody just standing near the villain when she sets that bomb off that could die.
Yeah.
She's willing to take that risk. She's always willing to play hardball to go after what she wants, and she's not afraid to bend those rules to see just how far they'll go before
bend
they break.
Bend my ass. She breaks those suckers in half all the time.
Yeah, she just carries a roll of duct tape to tape it up behind her so nobody knows she was there.
Well, but, until people start recognizing her duct tape, which has happened on more than a few occasions already.
Yeah, usually it's Batman.
Well, but, that's yeah, what he does.
But Waller is a great example of, yeah, some, like we were talking about with Sinestro, where you've got this character who very easily could be a villain playing a hero's role in the story. And certainly working for the government, she's put in a position that you think she's going to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen, you know, throughout that a lot of times government people are not heroes. They're running things for their own agenda. Think about the senators and the X-Men that are trying to pass the anti-mutant agendas.
Yeah. I just had an odd thought. And Waller's position in this is what made me think of it. Is Max Lord in the new 52?
Haven't seen him yet. Doesn't mean he's not around.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I couldn't remember if he was, because I know they had JLI, which is what he's most commonly tied to. For those of you listening, Max Lord was the previous leader of the JLI before he went a little bit off the cuckoo and decided to sort of brain control the entire world.
Yeah, he was another one that had high government position, and well, as he discovered he had powers, he started to get run away with what his ideals were versus
Well, he had a whole backstory thing right before the reboot that like explained why he did what he did and his whole reasoning for.
I think they may have felt that with what Max Lord can do, he's a bit too much of a danger to keep running around right now in the DCU, especially with the reboot.
Fun bringing him back, though.
Yeah, they very well may, and yeah, I could certainly see like a JLA story arc or a big summer crossover event when DC decides it's time to start doing those again, and Max Lord be behind it. Cause,
yeah, that'd be a good JLA-JLI crossover.
Yeah. So
that'd be fantastic. I would love that.
But yeah, Max Lord in the past has taken control of Superman, made him see things that weren't quite there so that Superman would attack people that he cared about, attack targets that Max Lord set out for him, thinking that he was defending Metropolis. So
He definitely one of the more dangerous villains in the DCU. I mean, no doubt about that. But that's a separate title. We were talking about Suicide Squad.
Yes.
Coming back to this, just kind of near the end of the book, I had to think that, I forget who the writer is on this, but he had mentioned that one of the focuses he wanted to do on this was wanted to show why Harley was dangerous in her own right. Like, what it is that actually makes her a dangerous character.
This is Adam Glass, by the way, though.
Glass, okay.
Yeah.
And at the end of this issue, I think we do finally see why she is, in fact, that dangerous. She's a competent fighter. She's, you know, good on the team so far as being able to get the job done. But you don't put a demented psychiatrist into a prison with a bunch of homicidal sociopaths and let her run wild. Because the inevitable result is that she will use her abilities as a psychiatrist to get them riled up and do the things that they do best. Kill each other.
Mass mayhem. Well, that's the thing, is she was never intended to be running free.
Yeah.
There was a slight snafu in the middle story. And Adam has definitely done an admirable job plotting this out, setting up the story points, and delivering the tale. I think he's fallen a little bit short on some of the actual details of the characterizations.
Yeah, especially with that in particular, because the guy's rationale of, oh, well, she's just a girl. What can she do? I mean, that type of sexist mindset maybe flew in the 50s, but in the modern day and age, anybody that reads that is going to go, hey, you're a fucking dumbass. Of course she can start some shit. Doesn't matter if she's a girl.
Especially when his boss is a female and he's working in a max security prison
yeah.
with guys that, you know, that he knows are handpicked to be dangerous. Yeah. So, there was that, and he's had a couple of points where Adams tried to have some snappy dialogue or quirky dialogue for the characters that just didn't quite.
Yeah, it didn't quite fall in. And along with that, too, with El Diablo, I feel like they are kind of like beefing up his skill set a little bit, and they did it in this one. But unfortunately, it just sort of fell flat. I mean, I think they want to bring this character to the forefront, but the character just doesn't really have enough, I don't know, gumption, enough chutzpah to really put him in the state that I think they're trying to get him to. I don't think he can hold it.
Well, yeah, we'll have to see how, because he's been doing a decent job developing the characters. It's just kind of that snappy, witty writing that, yeah, and to some extent, that's his weakness as a writer. And some writers are better at writing snappy dialogue than others. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just because you can write snappy dialogue doesn't mean you can plot out a script or tell a good story.
Yeah.
So I'd rather have this solid story with some mediocre dialogue of snappy quirks,
yeah,
snappy comebacks. Yeah, for me, that makes it a better story. Yeah.
Well, speaking of better stories, let me move on. We'll take a look at Avengers X-Sanction, because I think this actually was... I enjoyed this a lot more than I thought I would. I mentioned last week that this didn't really hold that much of a draw for me, but I went ahead and I picked it up anyways and started flipping through. This was actually pretty good as far as an overall story. It had a good compulsion for Cable to be doing what he was doing. It had a decent story. It had, a very good battle between Cable and Cap. Ended with a quasi-cliffhanger that was complete, you know, baloney. Anybody that's ever watched a movie or watched a TV show that was in multiple parts, I'm sorry, if all you show is blam and that's the end and you don't actually see a bullet spraying brain matter somewhere, it obviously wasn't what you think it is. I mean, that's like movie TV watching 101. Yeah. Unless you see it happen, it didn't happen.
Yeah, so I also agree. I enjoyed this more than I ever thought I would. I still didn't enjoy it a hell of a lot. I am kind of interested to see where it's going. Like you said, Cable's motivation for doing this is really interesting, especially since they've told him you've got 24 hours to live.
Yeah.
So maybe this will be the last Cable story we'll see. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
So on the other hand, you're right. The way they depicted the battle between Cap and Cable was great. It was visually and...
Well, it was nice to see somebody that actually gave Cap a good run for his money physically.
Yeah.
It just in a good back and forth, like.
And it didn't feel like somebody was just, oh, wait, so and so's got to win, so let's have the other guy take a fall. Yeah, it didn't feel that way at all. They did a good job with that.
It was just flat out good back and forth.
And as for the cliffhanger, when you get to the end of this book and you see that cliffhanger, you realize what you think happened can't have happened, because if they did what you think is going to happen, they'd have already shown it to you, and you'd have a shock ending.
Yeah,
they're not going to save that shock ending for the beginning of the next book unless they can top it in that next book. Which somehow that's going to make it.
I don't think they could do that. However, if they were to be able to do that, holy balls, that would be awesome.
But it's one of those things that you look at it and you go, it's this story involving this person and this person. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's not going
to
happen.
Unfortunately, there's some plot armor there, as my friend Bubba likes to say.
Yeah.
Plot. Yeah, the plot is going to keep characters alive no matter what should be happening. So, to me, this is the beginning of a fanboy wet dream where it's like, okay, let's see who Cable can fight this week. Oh, let's see who Cable's going to take out this week. So... There is a bit of that element, which is what Loeb tends to do. He tends to write stories of, oh, what's the great fight that people want to see? And now let's write that fight.
Mm-hmm. But I got to give him credit. As far as a Cap versus Cable fight, it was pretty good.
I did enjoy the fight.
Yeah.
So it'll be an interesting to see how this moves forward and wraps up. Now, another book that actually has moved forward in the title is Ghost Rider. Yeah, we discussed the previous two books. They've been one-shots. This actually begins a longer story arc in the series. And you get to see a couple of other characters show up that are more regulars from the Marvel Universe. It's not just ancillary characters to tell Alejandra's story as she got used to it. So I said after the last book that I'm like, okay, we've now got motivation. We've now told a story with her. I want to see her move on. And they've done that. They've actually given me what I want by pushing her character forward. And they're not dwelling on the couple of points that they've been on those first two issues, which was fine for those issues because it developed and set the tone for that character.
Well, how do you feel about the direction that they're taking her, though?
I'm okay with it. You know, it's a soul that doesn't believe she can be redeemed playing the vengeful spirit. So, yeah, she's out there. She, to some extent, she wants to be redeemed. She doesn't believe she's capable of it. So she can only go out and take vengeance on those that also should be looking for redemption.
Okay.
People that deserve it, she's taking vengeance out on them because they can't be redeemed either. And, this, they bring in the Avengers, which apparently means only Hawkeye shows up on the scene when they bring in the Avengers. And you also got Johnny Blaze. So
Johnny was around in the beginning of the story. When it was during Fear Itself, it was actually following Johnny, and Alejandra was the side character until at the end of Fear Itself and that focus shifted. Johnny stepped out, she stepped up, and then was out. So her coming back to him now was not entirely unexpected, but I think it's good to have him back because as far as snappy comebacks, Johnny can do it. And he is good at it.
Yeah, reading this, some of them I felt a little bit forced, but they were funny.
Yeah.
So I'm willing to let it slide because they were well done as far as snappy comebacks. They were witty.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of them felt a little bit forced of, let's have the character say this line to set up the snappy comeback.
Okay.
But overall, I think it was a good characterization for Johnny. I think it's going to be interesting because this is dealing with a past sin that Alejandra's looking to go and make right. She is looking to make that right. Blaze is getting the blame for it from the Avengers, and he's stuck in the middle. Meanwhile, there's these two robot motorcycle centaur sisters.
Which, I don't know where they came from. Ghost Rider's an old title. They gotta be back in his rogues gallery from somewhere because, this just like smack of early 90s just...
Well, yeah, it's two motorcycles that are definitely built to be, steel tanks with spikes coming off of them. And we know that they faced Blaze before because one of the sisters is dead from facing them.
Honestly, these characters make me think of something that would have been in a Sega video game circa 1992.
So I think what we're going to see is – I think that we may see them come back. They were kind of filler for this story arc as they pushed Hawkeye, Blaze, and
– Well, I almost wonder if they were sort of supposed to be the one and done of this issue. They'll be in and out and that's it.
It very well may be that they were one and done.
I kind of hope so, to be honest.
But with going to hell and having a dead sister already as part of that duo, there's something in there that tells me we might be seeing them come back. But hopefully they were one and done, yeah. They certainly weren't strong characters for the book. But they were more...
Hawkeye was much stronger.
Yeah,
I wished he'd have been the one and done of this issue.
Hawkeye definitely was just there to set up Johnny Blaze's quirks.
Oh, man.
I'm
sorry. Consider them avenged. What sort of BS line is that? I mean, I could see a 13-year-old reading this and going, oh, man, that was so cool. And everybody else looking at it and going, you know what? This is why comic book parodies exist. It's because of BS lines like that. Ugh. Horrible. Horrible.
On the other hand, because we just spent a couple minutes dogging a couple of characterizations and plot. And let's face it, I think the two centaur motorcycle chicks were just a MacGuffin for this issue.
Oh, absolutely.
As they took Blaze and Alejandra into hell. And now we're going to get to see Ghost Rider in hell.
With his natural domain to a certain extent. So, good place for him.
Her natural domain.
Yeah. The demon. I'm going with the demon. Well, the demon's genderless, I suppose. It's a demon.
Alejandra's the Ghost Rider. She's in hell.
All right.
Blaze is in hell as well. I'm sure he's been there before.
Yeah.
Won't be the last time.
No, I doubt that.
But speaking of hell,
Mistown
USA.
I wouldn't necessarily say speaking of hell. I would say speaking of some crappy dialogue or maybe...
people being put into hell.
The readers, depending upon what type of plot devices you like. Okay, enough beating around. Carnage USA, the number one of it came out this week, or, yeah, excuse me, this month, whatever. I've been a Carnage fanboy for a bit. I love the idea of the Carnage character, just, especially in the Marvel Universe, where they tend to not be quite as gritty, I think, as the DCU tends to be, as far as just flat-out violence.
Yeah,
Marvel, not that Marvel hasn't had it, but it's never been as overt as it is in Carnage titles. And in this one, it's absolutely no exception to the rule. Because he's basically, Cletus Kasady is out again. He's running around doing his, you know, psycho kooky mass murderer thing. But at this time, he's taken over a town in the Heartlands and has decided he wants to kind of settle down a bit and start a family. So he begins infecting the local citizens with the symbiote, I guess is the best way to put it.
That's exactly what's happening here. Is he's infecting the citizens. I don't remember him ever having mind control through the symbiote as part of his powers.
Well, more than that, too, is the whole idea of this infected trope being used, overused, in my opinion, between Marvel Zombies. You have Infected in the IDW crossovers. You had the Living Dead in the DCU.
You have a zombie and iZombie.
That's Vertigo, different things. But the idea of this whole thing of the spread, even in Fear itself, we've seen that with the hammers and then the infecting the heroes and them being turned to bad. The Avengers come in to try to quell this.
Final Crisis.
So. Yeah, yeah. So in this, the Avengers come in to, or no, excuse me, not the Avengers.
They were Avengers. It was not your classic Avengers lineup. It was your...
Yeah, the new Avengers.
It was kind of the mid-90s. You had Cap, you had Wolverine, Spider-Man, the ever-loving thing.
That they make fun of the entire time, which, by the way, that was funny.
Yes.
That was funny. Yeah. Cliff was in this too, wasn't he? Hawkeye, I think. Yeah, because he's the one that's giving Spidey all the crap about Ben. Okay, so, that was entertaining. I'll give credit where credit is due. But, you know, you send in the big guns, and then, oops, they get infected.
The other part that kind of had me going, is... Ben comes along carrying the sonic gun, which, if I recall, the sonic gun didn't work on Carnage. It works on Venom.
Yeah.
But Carnage was different, and they had to find a different way because the sonic gun didn't work on him like they thought it would when they first tried it back when Carnage was first created from Venom.
Well, so, I think the sonics and fire do work on him the same way they do on Venom, but I think his tolerance to them was much higher than Venom's. It's not like the cure-all type thing like it is with him.
Okay. So maybe that's what it was, because I remembered that, whereas Venom succumbed to the sonic gun immediately in the early issues, Carnage shook it off, basically.
Yeah.
So, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's a souped-up version of the sonic gun, and that's what Ben took.
Possibly.
But, yeah, it certainly was bad that you had this whole team of superheroes, and everybody but Spidey immediately gets infected as soon as they touch down.
Kind of weak. Yeah. But what they're setting up for, and what I'm looking forward to, I think as well as you, is the idea of the other symbiotes, the other offspring from Venom, are now looking to be tapped to come in and quell the situation. So we have, not only you have Venom, which is currently, I can't think of his name, Flash Thompson. You have Anti-Venom, which is the current Eddie Brock incarnation, where he's created antibodies against the symbiote specifically. You have Toxin, who's the other offspring, is the offspring of Carnage, who had a short run for a while in the 2000s, and I thought it was a kind of interesting character. He wanted to do a cop, so he had a sort of good, bad, and a rather childlike quality to him. And then a couple others that I didn't particularly recognize, but I think I had heard the names before in reference to.
Yeah, and you actually had stories. Venom, who was top secret as far as who actually is Venom presently.
Well, no, he was MIA.
Was it MIA?
Yeah, he's MIA. Because Flash went off on something and he's doing something. So, no, the classified one was...
No, it was the Venom. I'm pretty sure it was... It was the actual Venom.
It was classified because
See symbiote on symbiote action is what's going to happen.
Gotta love it.
On symbiote crime. Actually, the symbiotes are another one of those things that Marvel, I think, did too much of. The original concept with the symbiote, when they brought Spider-Man back from the Secret Wars, he would get rid of the costume, and Eddie Brock would originally take it up, be Venom for a little while, and then pass it on to the next person, and the symbiote would rotate through people. Unfortunately, Venom was huge.
He was hugely popular.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's exactly what I mean. He was huge. So they said, wait a second, we can't take this character away. Everybody wants to see this character. So what do? Well, it's an alien symbiote. Let's have it reproduce. And they gave it to Cletus Kasady. And they were going to have Cletus, and they were going to have the symbiote for Carnage pass on from person to person. Unfortunately, Cletus Kasady was even bigger than Eddie Brock as far as popularity. So now they were even screwed again.
But then they decided, okay, well, let's have both of them create offspring. We'll create a whole bunch of them. Well, and all of them sucked. And nobody liked any of them.
Well, it would make for a great story arc if they would follow one symbiote as it went from person to person to person. And, you know, they did that original story arc, you know, that they had intended to do. Unfortunately, they had two huge successes. And actually, they got more vicious and violent with each success of one, which is why Carnage became so huge. Now, it'll be interesting to see just how violent this is going to get with symbiote on symbiote fighting. Spider-Man, of course, is still in that action, but somehow the rest of the Avengers taken out of the equation. Now, you might as well just have had Spider-Man show up. You know, I'm not sure where they're going
to
go.
By himself, yeah.
I suppose there's going to be some sort of a battle between the heroes and Spidey or something.
Yeah, I would imagine.
But, yeah.
Anyway.
Overall, the art in this.
Definitely, yes. Yes.
It's digital art. Yeah, it's very realistic.
It's gorgeous. I mean, it is just flat out beautiful. Yeah. If nothing, I mean, not only the internal art, the cover art as well. I mean, from cover to cover, it's just beautiful. I mean, it's so cool. It's so clean. It's very evocative of what it's trying to convey emotionally.
Well, one thing that I'm wondering, though, is it that it is this wonderful art, or are we just not used to seeing this digital style of art as much so that it stands on its own compared to traditional comic book art, and that as we start to see more and more of this come into comics, which we will, are we going to come back and look at this and go, it's not quite as great as we thought it was? I don't think that's going to be the case. I
don't think so either, because if you look at artists like Alex Ross, who did that sort of hyper-realistic, but in painting,
yes,
it's still just as gorgeous today as it was the first day it came out. Yeah. It's more recognizable. People look at it and go, oh, well, that's an Alex Ross thing.
But
that doesn't mean that their appreciation for it has waned at all.
Right. But this is a different style than the art that Ross does. And I'm not saying that painting versus digital in any way is making one form better than another form.
It's almost kind of an apples and oranges comparison.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. But what I'm actually talking about is, are we going to look back and seeing more digital art and look at this and go, we didn't really have a handle on the medium yet, what the guy who did the art in this book did in 5 years and come back and look at this and go, yeah, we were stunned to see how great this looked now, but the way they've progressed with the art that they can do on computers or what this artist
it's like looking back at the CG that was done in the movie Blade.
Yes.
And then looking at Avatar today and looking at Blade and going, wow, we actually thought that was good?
Yes.
Yeah, that same type of idea.
Yeah.
And
it happens. You watch movies all the time and go, those effects just don't know.
Oh, I mean, Godzilla was...
Yeah. And that's what I'm wondering King with Kong this book. Well. Is it because it's so new? I remember a couple months back there was a Batman book that had a lot of digital effecting to it, made it look very Tron-ish. And I'm kind of wondering the same thing. Yeah, as I finished reading that, I was kind of going, this had a really unique look. I liked it. I don't know if I'd want to continue reading an entire series like this.
Yeah.
This is a different style of digital art, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I can certainly see reading this because it's much more closer to a traditional comic book art.
So instead of being gimmicky, it's doing what it's intended to do, which is convey the story.
Yes, it's just an unusual medium for it.
Right.
Which I think we're going to see become more and more prevalent. And actually, it's not even the medium itself that's unusual. Now, most comic stuff is done on computers. It's just the style and technique that's done through this computer.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hyper-realistic computer, as opposed to a cel-shaded type of a comic look that we normally get. So,
as a quick mention for this week, Written 32, we've been following this one for a while. We've mentioned it back and forth. Mm-hmm. This is mid-arc. It does have one thing we did want to mention, and you brought it up first, was how this book kind of. You take it because I don't want to try to explain it.
Well, there's certainly an interesting literary twist on how Tommy Taylor, the main character of this book, draws his power. It's something that we've seen in mythology and in stories before, and I just wasn't really expecting to see it in this book, which is why it shocked me and I was like, oh, that's really kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
because they were creating this character that you envisioned in one way, and now it's flipping the script on how you actually view this entire character. So,
well, and the device that they use is most common, I know you mentioned mythology, is most commonly used with deities, and the idea of them gaining their power from the masses, which this book has touched on many, many times before.
Yes.
Not only for the character, but for literature as a whole.
And actually, the Cabal itself is about controlling that power of the masses.
Right.
So
what I think is the big twist on this, more than anything else, is that idea of connection, of network. Because that's what then takes that that classic idea and modernizes it. And brings it into something that really can have its teeth, so you sink your teeth into as far as modern day.
Yeah, it really is. And, what we're seeing here is the enemy getting ready to strike back as the hero recovers from his initial battle with them. So, again, it's mid-arc, and right now what they're doing is 0.5, so they're putting out 2 issues a month.
Yeah.
So we'll be getting number 32.5 soon, which will be a side story to go along with this.
Yeah.
And then the main stories are going in the main numbers, and the 0.5s are side stories for it. So,
I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
Let's bring that up.
Well, speaking of things that we may have forgotten about, we're actually going to go back to a book called Carbon Gray. We read the trade of this.
Yeah, we mentioned this one last week, and you had said you were going to read it and come back and give us your opinion. So what is your opinion?
I love this. Again, this is another hyper-realistic art style. There was actually
put this more in almost like the anime kind of department.
There's actually a couple of different art styles in here. Some of it looks painted. Some of it looks more like it's charcoals. Some of it looks like it's digital. They have a real...
But the overall feel doesn't necessarily change from style to style.
No, the medium is actually changing, but the style of the artists remains very constant. Actually, you look at this book, there's a number of different artists that are involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep that style and to keep it feeling as if it's one fluid piece throughout this whole book...
is impressive.
It's very impressive. The story is a great story. It's one of those unwieldy types of stories that can easily get out of hand, and they've kept them together.
Well, this one does a bit.
No, but the main story arc and plot, they're able to pull you through. There is some stuff that, this book actually had a kind of a summary at the end as written by the two main characters when they were children, as if they were telling you a fable as children. And that helped reveal a couple of key story points that they didn't quite get across in the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Something like a character that has the ability to read the minds of dead people. They didn't quite get that across in the story. There were a couple of pages that I went back, and having known that, I look at it and go, oh, this makes much more sense now. Or this, there was one splash page that I was going, this is all things we've seen before. Why are we getting this? And it's because they were showing you what the character was seeing in the minds.
Yeah, they're showing you the ability, but that particular depiction of that ability didn't convey it very well.
It didn't
really give you the idea of this is what is actually happening.
Yeah, this is an ability the character has. They didn't quite purvey that.
Yeah.
But this book, parts of it remind me of Indiana Jones. Parts of it reminds me of Game of Thrones. There's a whole jockeying for who's going to be in control. Generals fighting kings and queens. And so there's the Kaiser's been assassinated. Who's going to take over and be the next person in charge? So there's lots of what's going on in the background. There's some espionage. Again, there's one character that kind of reminds me of Indiana Jones as a con man.
I was wondering, for anybody that's been playing PS3, I would actually say he's a lot more like Nathan Drake.
So, not being familiar with the game and PS3, I can't say that. But for me, it was kind of like a con man mixed with Indiana Jones. He's got a plane stashed away that he's conned himself into, and he takes that plane and flies off. And you kind of get that feel.
Because that is Nathan Drake. That's exactly what he is.
And, you're going into this world where it's 1919 or so. It's a World War I type atmosphere with some steampunk inventions.
Mm-hmm.
Planes are a bit more advanced than they would be for that actual time period, but they're not modern machinery. So it's got that steampunk element to it. There's a lot of really cool stuff in here. We also read the first issue of the two-part origins that they're putting out. I'm waiting for the rest of this. I want the next trade to come out because I really enjoyed this. I want to see where they're going to go with it.
Yeah, I think we can both say that if you do find this out on a trade rack or in your local bookstore, pick it up. I mean, it's as I mentioned last week, how did I put it? It was steampunk, politics, violence, and I had something else in there too.
Yeah.
Adventure maybe, or action or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you don't like any of those things, don't pick it up. If you like all those things, this is your book. I'm going to jump into a couple things that I was reading this week. First off is Lock and Key, which I have harped on numerous times on our podcast, and it's for damn good reason. It's because the book is awesome. Go read it. This particular issue, Clockworks for the past couple issues have been doing a lot of backstory, a lot of history, historical, and we've seen two of the main characters kind of pop in as like ghostly characters throughout it.
Well, for a little bit of history on Lock and Key, it's been going in 6-issue arcs,
yes,
of 1 through 6.
Mm-hmm.
So this is actually Clockworks Volume 3, so it's number 3 of 6,
yes,
in the Clockworks story arc.
Which is volume, I want to say, 4? 4? Yeah. Well, so, it's Welcome to Lovecraft, Head Games, Crown of Shadows, Keys to the Kingdom, so this is actually number 5,
yeah.
Volume 5.
Yeah, if you need to, go back, pick up Welcome to Lovecraft.
Yeah, you'll read them all the way through.
You'll get sucked into the story.
I would actually say, if you can find them, get the hardcovers for these books. I think I mentioned it before, but the hardcover trades of these are just fantastic books to have. There's a lot of extra art in the back of different alternate covers, different sketch art and stuff like that. And
they're fantastically put together.
They're just great books to have. They're good for collectors. They're also just good for readers.
And for what you're going to pay for that hardback book versus trying to find them as, yeah, unless you find them in the 50-cent bin, you know, even the dollar bin, you're going to wind, you might as well go ahead and, yeah, you know, rather than buying them on the rack anew,
mm-hmm,
go ahead and buy that hardcover book. You're going to spend the same, maybe even save some money buying it hardbound.
And you'll enjoy it a lot more, yeah, I think.
And you'll get a lot more use out of it.
But to continue on with this, this particular story in this arc is sort of like the aha issue. This is the one that, for the entirety of this entire story, or title series, this is the one where you finally get the explanation as to why. Why is all of this happening? So this is a big, I don't necessarily want to say a turning point issue, because it's not too difficult to figure out where this was coming from, but it just ramps you up to get these last 3 books in and to really see how it is the S hit the F.
Well, this Clockworks story arc is more of a origin story for the entire series, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
like I said, two of the main characters, Kinsey and her older brother, whose name escapes me at the moment, whatever. They keep showing up in these historical stories as like ghosts that are observing. And this story, you find out why it is that that's happening.
Okay.
And they finally see the moment in time of where all of this started.
And this is book 3 of series 6 of 7 series.
Yeah, volume 5. Yeah, they've said of 7 total volumes that they're going to end up doing. This has been written all the way to the end already by Joe Hill. He's already gotten this completely planned out, and I want to say even maybe written out.
Yeah. He may have some dialogue and stuff that he's got to fill in a couple of places, but it's already done.
Yeah.
So it's just waiting for it to come out.
Exactly.
And I hate waiting for it.
Oh, God, it's so good. The other one, continuing with the DCU number 4, is Grifter number 4 came out this week. This is part 2 of my week of Archers. First one showing up in Ghost Rider. Second one showing up here. This was Grifter versus Green Arrow.
And he was also in Carnage.
Oh, yeah, he was in Carnage. Yes, this is part 3 then. Damn, this has been the week of Archers. No doubt about it. And no, for those of you who are asking, I have not yet watched Archer. I do need to. I've been told it's hilarious. I'll get there eventually. Get off my butt. Get off my back. Like I was saying, though, Grifter versus Green Arrow, this is a really fun confrontation. They had a great fight. And what this book was good at, and I don't know if this is what they intended, I kind of hope it was, this book really showed the difference in levels between these two characters. Somebody that is a professional superhero in Green Arrow, the guy that has the connections with Oracle, who has the connections with the JLA, the guy who can get stuff done, versus Grifter, the man on the run, but who's a fantastic soldier, an excellent fighter, is crafty as hell. The two of them going at odds and seeing, okay, yeah, Green Arrow has all this stuff that he can do and all these people.
The guy with the resources.
Got the resources. Exactly. And the guy with the resources shows why it's good to have the resources and puts Grifter on his heels.
Is Oracle actually in this?
As a speech bubble.
interesting because Oracle's what is Barbara Gordon, or at least in the original DC universe was Barbara Gordon,
you know what,
while she was in her wheelchair. So she's now got her own series. She's got her legs back as Batgirl, which I'll talk about a little bit later. So to actually have Oracle in this, it makes me wonder, are they bringing Oracle out in as its own
character? That I'm thinking about it, I think I might be wrong. I think this is actually Green Arrow's his assistant or something, actually.
That actually makes more sense, because...
I'm trying to think of her name, though. He does mention it in here.
Because Oracle's a character that they've really kind of... They actually killed in the original DC Universe. And yet somehow she still remained around for a couple of months before they did the reboot. Yeah, now... With the reboot, Barbara Gordon has gone off to become Batgirl again.
Okay.
She has not been Oracle, so...
Okay, I was mistaken. It was, in fact, it's not Oracle. It is Naomi, who is, it looks like, Queen's personal assistant, but she's playing that same Oracle-type role. Okay. She's feeding him the constant information during the fight and is acting as his second eyes and ears.
What would be interesting is they had a character, I think they were calling her Firewall, that was working with Oracle at the end of... the old DC Universe. Be interesting to see if they kind of took that same character, maybe did a couple of tweaks on it, but made that the new Oracle for the new DC Universe, or continued with that as Firewall, and maybe she had some connections with Barbara Gordon as Oracle earlier on.
Yeah, something like that.
They could certainly bring somebody into that role,
mm-hmm.
but right now they're letting that step to the side. We'll have to see if that develops in DC.
Yeah. So as a quick go back to what I was talking about before, though, this is showing that fight and that battle. I already talked about Green Arrow's pluses. With Grifter's pluses, it's his flat-out resourcefulness. And that no matter what is being brought against him, he somehow keeps weaseling and squeezing and sliding and just not getting captured. Yep. Being just out of the way, just close enough to not getting caught, and then he eventually actually does briefly get caught. So between the two, you see which one is the better. It's the pro. The pro is better than the amateur, but... the amateur gets a little outside help. So,
yeah, but you know, it also takes a good writer to be able to write that, because at some point you got to go, really? He got out of that? Give me a break. So to have a good writer that can actually write that story without you getting that type of feeling from it,
mm-hmm.
that's something that is really big. And yeah, it sounds like you didn't have that problem with the book, which is great.
Oh, yeah,
That's a great writer.
As a matter of fact, I know you're not reading this series, but I may pass this issue to you to read it just because I think you'll enjoy it. So
yeah, it sounds like I'd really enjoy it. And I would think you're gonna have to hand it over.
A couple others I want to mention real quick this week: Resurrection Man number 4, continuing his story arc, Heaven and Hell are fighting over him. It's becoming increasingly more difficult to figure out who's on what side, though, and I think there's even a middle ground that's kind of fighting for him too. So this was still interesting to watch. I'm going to continue.
And Resurrection Man's the guy that every time he dies, he comes back with a new power.
Yes.
So that is right. Although it's always painful for him to do that. So.
Yeah, very painful. Currently, he has a sonic scream. That's his most recent one. He sonic screams at an angel over and over and over again until eventually she just gets pissed off and smacks him down. Very funny. Shade number 3, story continues. I'm not even going to get into that one. The next one, though, Mouse Guard Black Axe. If you've been reading Mouse Guard, you already know it's a fantastic title, fantastic story. Excellent series. For those of you who don't know, Mouse Guard is the comic that reads like a classic epic. It really does almost read like something of a Gilgamesh or an Iliad or Odyssey. It's that type of language, that type of story. Black Axe is the story of... it's a continuation. The Black Axe is a item in the Mouse Guard universe that's almost sort of like a relic, a legendary relic. In this case, the Black Axe has been lost, was recently found in the possession of a bunch of weasels. I think it's either weasels or ferrets. I'm pretty sure it's weasels. And it's a king weasel who the previous Black Axe brought the axe in front of him, said, "Hey, I'm all big and bad," and the weasel just ate him. And kept the axe on a pouch at his side as a reminder of, this is what happens to people that try to step up to me. Well, these members of the Mouse Guard have arrived there, find that he does in fact have the axe, but when they go back and forth a bit, they say they want the axe back, the weasel tells them no. The weasels then have one of their guys come in that's been attacked by a fox that's living in some briars and brambles outside of their kingdom. The young mouse that wants the axe steps up and says, "I'll go kill that fox for you. And if you do, or if I do, I get the axe." And the Weasel King says, "All right, well, fine. But you know what? She stays here. Just to make sure that you can't take the axe and split," because he wants the axe as part of the deal to kill the fox.
Right.
So he takes her as collateral, says, "You got 24 or 48 hours. if you're not back in that time, she's my lunch and I'm coming after you next. So Mouse Guard follows actual mice. And it's sort of like how they would survive in this kind of world if they did have the ability to
do medieval mice.
Medieval mice, it's fantastic. Fighting against weasels, foxes, hawks, owls, the things that are their natural enemies.
Okay.
So, other books that I have that I need to read this week, I didn't get a chance to read yet. American Vampire number 24, which is The Thing in the Cave, part 3. Pigs number 4, continuing the story of the sleeper cell agents from Russia that were in Cuba and have now come to America. Samurai's Blood number 6, which finishes off the Samurai's Blood series, the finale of that. I am eagerly looking forward to finishing that. And the Danger Girl Army of Darkness crossover number 4, which I want to say might be the end of that one as well. That one's just... That's me eating frosting. That's all that is. It's horrible for me. I shouldn't be reading it. It's utter and complete trash. I can't stop.
You'll rot your teeth out by eating that.
You're damn right, and I'll love every second of it.
Yes. Okay, well, I mentioned earlier Batgirl. We kind of talked about it with her previous life as Oracle. I mentioned her that I was going to get back to her. Well, time to get back to her with Batgirl number 4. All right. Yeah, this has been a great run. Gail Simone's been exploring Barbara's emotions and how she actually deals with being Batgirl, especially now that she's regained the use of her legs. She went from being crippled in a wheelchair that the Joker put her in. If you want to read that, Alan Moore's The Killing Joke.
Highly recommended. A classic story.
Yes. And, so Barbara's now got her legs back. There's another hint as to how she got her legs back. They've been kind of dropping small little pieces here and there.
Yeah, they haven't fully explained it, have they?
No. There's been no full explanation yet. There's mention of a clinic in some faraway country. They actually state the country, just slipping my mind. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, okay, so she had to travel to get this. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of hints. But the other thing is she's facing this villain, the Mirror, which helps reflect – which is really designed to be a mirror of Barbara. It's reflecting back the emotions and the feelings that she has and that she's had to deal with between being the victim of the crime, being a survivor, survivor's guilt. So there's a lot of that going on in here.
Well, as she was the only one actually harmed, how does survivor's guilt really apply to that?
Well, she wasn't really the only one that was actually harmed. There's a lot of psychological damage that was done to her father.
Because
the Joker, after shooting Barbara, took footage of what he did to her, which...
was not nice stuff.
Yeah. They actually...
And we'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. The stuff that has Alan Moore supposedly had taken out of the script is actually really bad, even though we do have an explicit tag on here. We're not going to discuss it. So let your imagination run wild. But that's the type of stuff that Jim Gordon was forced through a funhouse to watch the Joker do to his daughter, as he tried to
funhouse.
Yeah, as Batman tried to capture the Joker. So, yeah, there was a lot of depth in that story. It was a mean, nasty story. A lot of people were wondering, Bruce Wayne had his back broken by Bane. Why didn't Barbara get her legs back? Just like Bruce did. So finally, she's got it. Yeah, and as this arc goes on, we're going to get a bit more of the story, But it really is, a bit of that, survivor guilt or, who do you blame for the pain and the accidents that you've been through. So there's actually a surprise appearance at the end of this story that you won't see coming. Even if you've been reading Batman and Batgirl for a long time, you probably will not be seeing this person coming. So... yeah, it's a nice little shock surprise ending that's going to lead into kind of the new arc because this does wrap up the arc where Barbara's fighting the Mirror. But I can see them continuing with trying to figure out who Barbara Gordon is as a character and as Batgirl in the DC Universe. The other big book that I read this week was G.I. Joe Snake Eyes. Snake Eyes and Duke kicking Cobra ass, finding a cure for the disease that Duke had. This is the end of this arc, so of course Duke gets the cure. Yeah, I know, spoiler. But, it's Duke. Face it, you're going to be seeing him in future G.I. Joe comics. This is also the last of this arc from the Cobra Civil War crossover. Again, they kept this fairly separate, just the timeline, and one of the main villain characters, Vargas, was one of the contenders for Cobra Commander. But overall, you don't have to read the other two G.I. Joe books to get the full story of what's going on with the G.I. Joe Snake Eyes book. Next book, we're going to have You know, G.I. Joe is going to start its reprisals against Cobra for what happened during Cobra Civil War. And I can see nothing less than Snake Eyes kicking a whole lot of Cobra ass in the next coming books. So I'm looking forward to those.
So, wonderful. Okay. I may have come to the point where I'll start reading those just to watch some Cobra head knocking, because that's fun stuff.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Cobra head knocking and some fun stuff, they actually just had the trailer for G.I. Joe Retaliation put out there on the internet.
Yep.
And this looks so much better than that pile of crap that they released.
not a single exoskeleton to be found.
This looks like the G.I. Joe characters that we knew growing up as action figures doing the stuff that we wanted them to do as action figures if they were real.
Which I have to say, to a certain extent, does kind of give me a blip on my hokey radar, because I don't know if I'll be able to look at this seriously. I don't know if I'm supposed to look at this seriously. If I'm not, by all means, expect
big explosions, lots of action.
Yeah.
Yeah. Probably some snappy dialogue from a couple of characters. No snappy dialogue from Snake Eyes.
This has got
Red Ninjas versus Snake Eyes and what's probably Jinx. Jinx is in this movie.
This really does look like it's going to be sort of like a ninja extravaganza.
Well, half of the original's comic book series was focused a lot on ninjas. The RZA is actually going to be the Bind Master. They revealed that a long time ago, which is kind of odd. How is, you know, this guy who's a black rapper, Snake Eyes, his uncle, but so maybe they've kind of rewritten that actual character's role, but there's inspired casting with The Rock as Roadblock. And to see him on top of a tank with a 50 caliber just blazing away in the trailer,
that does warm the cockles of your heart, I got to admit.
This is going to be pure fun. I think it's going to do it a lot better than the previous movie did. Cobra Commander actually looks like Cobra Commander in this.
Yeah, and it's looking like this is going to be the same type of fun that The Expendables is going to have as well. Oh. Which, speaking of, that trailer came out. Was it this week as well that they released that, or was it
this week? I think it was last week. Okay. Expendables. Again, this was the stars of the 80s and early 90s action movies going, we need to make movies like that again. And they came out with Expendables. Yeah, it was. It was fun. It was big explosions. Yeah, it's got Schwarzenegger, Bruce Willis, and Stallone all standing together in one room.
But then you just start adding on the names. You add on guys like, I think,
Dolph Lundgren.
JVD, Dolph Lundgren.
Well, JVD wasn't in the original.
Not in the original.
He's in the new one.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, Dolph was in it.
Yeah.
You
got Jet Li, who was in the original. He'll be back in the new one.
I want to say Jason Statham.
Mickey Rourke was in the original.
Yeah.
And, of course, this new one, not only did they get, you know, Bruce Willis, who's also going to be playing Joe Colton, as also inspired casting in the G.I. Joe, but you're going to have Schwarzenegger back. And I believe they show him firing a gun, so you get to see Schwarzenegger give me some action. Of course, Stallone's going to be in it. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they had to ramp it up a notch by getting Chuck Norris.
Oh, that I did not see. That's interesting.
So you got Chuck. Yeah,
Chuck's been out there again. He's been doing more. He actually did World of Warcraft commercials, so he's out there doing that now.
Well, let's face it. This movie's nothing but explosions and fun. And, yeah, Stallone wrote it, so you're not going to expect it to be, you know, the smartest written book thing, but it'll be a decent enough story that you can, that, okay, A follows B follows C, explosions.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, A follows explosion, follows B follows explosion, follows C follows, yeah. Anyways, finishing our trifecta of things going boom, the Ghost Rider Spirit of Vengeance trailer, which actually had come out before, they just released their second trailer, which I want to say I think was actually coming out with, what was the big movie from this past weekend? Sherlock Holmes. I think they were showing it with that. That's another just fun trailer to watch, very interesting. We get to actually see a really neat CG of Nick Cage's face actually morphing into the skull as he's riding in a really kind of a neat effect.
This is another one where I think the sequel is going to stomp the ever-loving crap out of the original.
I gotta say, I enjoyed the original. It was fun.
It was fun. It wasn't great.
But
I think that's where I think they've figured out, okay, we've kind of set up stuff. Now we can really amp it up. Yeah. And there's just some beautiful looking action sequences. I don't know how it's going to turn out as a cohesive story.
It probably won't.
But yeah,
there's a scene. I'm kind of okay with that, to be honest.
Yeah, there's a scene in this, and I know you commented on it, where the ghostwriter just tosses this guy in the sky.
Oh.
And he's got he's got the chain wrapped around the guy, and he just swings him back to Earth.
What goes up must come down in a glorious fashion.
And he'd make sure he came down much harder than necessary.
Yeah, well, much harder than he went up, no doubt. A couple of quick mentions, since we're talking about trailers. And this is for the people that are in the manga and anime world. A live-action trailer has been released for Rurouni Kenshin. So we'll get to see Batosai the Manslayer in all of his live-action glory.
And you said that looked actually fairly accurate to what the story is.
Yeah, the characterizations and the actors that are portraying them look spot on.
It's a bit difficult to tell because the trailer's in Japanese, and while you know a little bit, yeah, you're not fluent. And
no, far from it.
Yeah, you can pick out a word here and there.
I don't think it's going to come stateside. It would be my guess. But for those of you who do enjoy following that particular realm, this is something that should be a blip on your radar.
Well, this actually may eventually make it over. They've been starting to pull more stuff. There's the Protector, which was brought over by the guy who did Pulp Fiction, whatever that guy's name was.
Yeah.
He presented that. So there's been a couple of those bigger budget action movies. Part of it is the studios want to see that they do really well overseas to say, we're willing to take the risk on bringing it here.
I don't know if this one will be worth the risk. There's a very strong and very fervent fan following, and a lot of people liked it. I just don't know if it's going to have enough draw. Which is why I said, if it'll come over, it'll come over as an import. It'll come over in original language. You'll find it in the international section of, oh, wait, that's right, you don't have video stores anymore.
That's right. That's fine, because I got it on Netflix. I'm sure I'll be able to stream it. If not, I'll be getting the DVD. Yeah. It's one of those. It does have a big fan base over here too. So
yeah,
they may try and grasp on to that. Yeah, you know, particularly if it does well with the fan base over there, that they feel it's a faithful adaptation. They might try and pull onto the fan base that they know is over here to get it into at least limited release.
They tried to do the same thing with Death Note, and Death Note I think had like four or five movies in Japan, or not that many, maybe like two or three movies in Japan, and you never saw a squat of it over on this side of the shore. Yeah.
Well, anyways, with limited release though. There's different things that could happen. Actually, one of those things with limited release is we're actually going to get a Full Metal Alchemist movie coming into limited release, New York, L.A., possibly a couple of other major cities.
Should note, this is animated, not live action.
Yeah. Full Metal Alchemist is a independent standalone from both Full Metal Alchemist, the original animated series, and Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood.
Which is reboot. It's the more traditional
to the actual manga that was written.
Uh-huh.
This is a standalone story from those, but there is a chance that it may come to a theater near you because it is coming to, New York, LA, and a couple of other cities.
And they said I guess there's like petition sites and things like that where you can actually go and vote to have it try to get it to your area. Probably in your independent theaters around us, it'd be things like Tampa Theater, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Where they'll pick up the little indie
draft
things.
House
in
Boston.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's definitely got a chance that you can see something like this. But no, not everybody needs to be going to the movies and watching stuff. Sometimes, you want to set your comics aside, you want to set your movies aside, you want to sit down, you want to have a nice read.
And as far as nice reads go, recommendations from Neil deGrasse Tyson shouldn't be far from your want to read list. Those of you who don't know, Neil deGrasse Tyson is kind of he's kind of a big deal when it comes to scientists.
Well, he's a astronomer
and is the
head of the
planetarium in New York. I forget the specific name of which one it is.
Which is really bad because we listen to his show all the time.
Yeah,
Hayden Planetarium.
Yes, thank you very much. He has the Star Talk podcast, which is very good, and we recommend you do listen to after you listen to ours. And he's very personable. He's sort of kind of like...
he's got one of those resonant voices that's just comforting to listen to, that it's very independent. You can identify it right off the bat.
And he has a fantastic personality as well. He's very personable. He's very funny. He's very, I would not necessarily say bubbly, but he just seems like he'd be a really just cool guy to sit down and talk to. Yeah. Well, recently he was on Reddit and he did an AMA, an Ask Me Anything, which is a common type of article that comes out on Reddit, usually by a bunch of, there have been many, many celebrities that have done AMAs. But in particular in this one, one of the questions that was asked was what book should be read by every single intelligent person on the planet? And DeGrasse gave his list, and on this list it was the Bible, which he doesn't specify what version, but people were assuming he meant King James, and there's a little bit of argument after that as far as which one to read. The System of the World by Sir Isaac Newton, On the Origin of Species by Charles Darwin, Gulliver's Travels by Swift, The Age of Reason by Paine, I believe that's Thomas Paine, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
The Wealth of Nations by Smith, The Art of War by Sun Tzu, and The Prince by Machiavelli.
The Art of War is the actual book, The Art of War, not The Art of War in Business or many of the other adaptations of it. Get the actual book.
Yeah, the original.
By the way, it's not that long.
No, it's really not. To which he follows up with, if read all of the works above, you will have a profound insight into most of what has driven the history of the Western world. And I think by his saying this, what he means is these are the pieces of literature that if you read these and you understand not only the content, but understand the times around them, the world around the time that they were written and why they were written, you will then begin to grasp and understand. You'll understand the past that has created the present and will create the future as well.
You'll understand the context that they were written in, and thus how they shaped the future context of where they went. It's interesting that they said the Western world with The Art of War in there, which is an Eastern work. However, it is taught at West Point and other military colleges.
Well, because many of the ideas and the concepts of Sun Tzu have been utilized in the Western world.
Again, there's definitely still taught at West Point.
And more so modern, in the modern age.
And again, there are crappy knockoffs of that book that you can find for The Art of War and Business.
Oh, no, sorry, that's The Tao of Pooh. My mistake.
Yeah, completely different book and not so much a ripoff of The Art of War. All right, another fun little point, the Android phone Galaxy Nexus, which is the Google's premier phone for their Android operating system, just dropped with the Ice Cream Sandwich. Ice Cream Sandwich is the new code name for the new version of Android 4.0. Mm-hmm. And it's got some big changes to it. The phone is amazingly huge. It's almost to the point that you're going to have to call it a tablet if it gets any bigger. but they made it really thin. It's light. I love the phone. It's what I just picked up, so I had to talk about it because I've been using the original Droid, which was a dog.
The Droid X?
No, Droid.
Okay.
Yeah. Before the Droid X was the Droid.
Okay.
And apparently there was even an R2-D2 version of the Droid, which kind of obsessed me that I didn't get that, but...
Yeah, well.
The changes that they've made to the operating system, it takes you a while to get used to it because it is completely different. There are a couple of things that I've heard people complain about, and overall I think that once you get used to using it, you'll find that you prefer it to the older system. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been done is on the old Android phones, they had four home keys across the bottom.
Yep.
The home key, the menu key, the back button, and the search key. They've taken those away. They're now soft keys, which a lot of people are complaining, why'd you get rid of those keys? Because you still have that bar across the bottom. However, that's actually part of viewable screen. So, somebody could actually write a program that will move that. One of the Labs features for the new browser takes all the controls for the browser and you swipe them in from the side by moving your finger from the side of the screen in, and they pop up around your thumb. You could do that with the bottom buttons now. They also took away the menu button and the search button. They replaced the menu button with a open apps button, which makes the app switching a lot easier. And it keeps the apps live, so when you're going from app to app, you're going to have a much better experience switching between programs. I think it was a smart change. I've heard some people complain about the app switching button because it used to be you'd long press on the home key. There's a lot. One of the things that Google did when they first came out, one of the reasons it was such a bare-bones operating system when it came out, they expected and they wanted people to develop for it. They said, here's a bare-bones contact manager. Somebody's going to write a program that's going to do a much better job than we can do. We're going to let them do that because people will like that. And somebody else is going to come up with one that works differently from that. And people are going to like that as well. So we'll let people come up. Unfortunately, people didn't come up with those as much and as well as Google would like. Mm-hmm. So they had to come back and redesign and implement that into the operating system from scratch.
Yeah.
But it's still being open. It allows for a lot of that to be developed for it. Again, I can see that bottom bar going away completely by just swiping in from the side, and then you get your keys to choose from.
Yeah, somebody actually writing something that'll actually do that type of functionality.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I like is they can actually you can actually customize and create this system very different from and by making them software keys and with all the tweaks. I think they made it a much stronger system, and they've made it much more feature-packed to compete with iOS, which is, of course, the iPhone and the iPad. So they can now compete with that on a much bigger scale, even though they originally didn't intend to compete with their operating. They intended to have a skeletal system that people would build on all the features that they wanted the way that they wanted them.
Mm-hmm. So to make a long story short, you like it.
I love it. I got another fun little story.
Before we get to that, let's go back to comic news for 1 second, and unfortunately on a little bit more of a sad note, Joe Simon, the co-creator of Captain America, passed away this past week, which I believe now makes the second comic creator in as many weeks to have passed away, and the unfortunate sort of dogma is that bad things usually come in threes, so we're going to have to keep our head down for the next week and see if...
As they just proved with the hot hands theory about basketball players...
Yeah.
The bad things coming in threes is just a myth. It doesn't actually happen. We just tend to notice,
of course,
when it happens because somebody said it.
Just like bad drivers on a full moon or more pregnancies and on the 13th or whatever types of nonsense things that are out there.
But they actually just disproved the theory that basketball players get hot hands. They hit a 3-pointer, so they can take it the next 3-pointer and. They get a better chance of making it because they're hot.
However, it is completely true when playing NBA Jams. So, anyways, unfortunately, it's a bit of a sad note, but to go back to a lighter note, in the Czech Republic, there have been over 15,000 registrations of Jedi Knight as a religion in Prague.
Yeah. 15,000 Czechs have said that Jedi Knight is their religion in the official census of the country. In the city of Prague itself, there are nearly 4,000 Jedis in the city itself. Now, we're talking 0.3% of the population. It's not huge. But this is Jedi Knight. It's based off of Star Wars.
Yeah.
So,
which I kind of have to wonder what the Pastafarian stat would be in the Czech Republic. Which I have to admit, these are my people. The Chalupka name actually is a bastardization, a phonetic pronunciation of the name Chalupka. And Chalupka comes from Czech, means small cottage or small house. Many times, if you actually do an image search for Chalupka on the internet, you'll get a bunch of gingerbread houses. That's what you find that, and you find the hut of Baba Yaga, which is a house with chicken legs. My name means a house with chicken legs. And people wonder why I get so defensive about my damn name. It's that and because I'm referred to as a frickin' taco.
Yep. And you mentioned the Pastafarians earlier. There's actually a small town in Pennsylvania where they, for years they used to put up the nativity scene in front of the city hall. Because other groups started petitioning to be allowed... They took it down 1 year, and there was so much people arguing that they took it down. They said, fine, we'll put it up, and we'll allow the first 10 groups to sign up to put their own religious scenes up, which have included a skeletal Santa Claus nailed to a cross.
And what group was that?
The Jedi Knights actually put up a Luke Skywalker statue.
Okay, that's kind of cool.
And the Pastafarians are about to go out there to put their nativity scene where it's going to be a flying spaghetti monster instead of the baby Jesus, and there will be pirates instead of wise men.
So, I wonder if they can make that out of actual spaghetti and if it'll be overrun by ants.
I highly suspect it will be a plastic or rubber.
I would hope. I would really hope. Fun noodles. Fun noodles would work well for that.
But they will be. But he will be surrounded by pirates and a gnome. I'm not sure where the gnome came from, but. Pirates are the chosen people.
Yeah, who cares? Gnomes are awesome.
And the lack of pirates is why we have global warming.
As has been proven statistically.
Yes.
So. On that note, time to put this show to bed, I think, for tonight. As always, you can find us at thecomicbooknerd.com. We are also on iTunes at Comic Book Tesseract. Just do a search for us. You'll be able to find us. You can find us on Twitter. I am at Felix T. Cat. That's with a K and two T's. Jason is at J. Polyev. You can email us at comicbooktesseract@gmail.com, or you can also leave us a voicemail or a text at 50Tesseract. That's 508-377-3722. Well, that's it for this week. I'm Justin Chalupka. I'm half Jason Polyev. I'd like to say thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.